The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Yahoo Sports Radio 1560 from high atop the Gal building overlooking the Galleria. Here's Glenn Davis.
Welcome back to Yahoo Sports Radio 1560 AM. We bring in the general manager of the Houston Dynamo. He's the one and only Matt Jordan. Matt, how are you?
Hey, Glenn. How you doing this evening?
Very good. I mean, this is a big day for you guys because getting in under the final ticking moments of the transfer window, a 19-year-old signing from Colombia, Mauro Manotas. Tell us about him.
Yeah, well, you know, it was obviously, it's been a very long process from start to finish of tracking Mauro and scouting his progress. When the opportunity presented itself to add him before our primary window closed at the end of last week, you know, I've been down since then in Colombia working just to get this thing pinned up. And we're really happy to have Mauro as a part of the Houston Dynamo. He is, I mean, obviously we see what's happening on the world scene of soccer right now with the Colombian Federation, the way their national team performed. Their U-20 national team right now is the top five team in the world, their U-17 team, and they're really producing top talent. So we feel our hard work has paid off to beat a lot of clubs to the punch to get this kid.
He's got an impressive pedigree. Now, he's only 19 years of age. He played at the Under-20 South American Championships this year.
Yes.
Take us into sort of the dynamics of what type of player this is. I mean, I think we all know in general some of the traits of Colombian players, but you've seen him. We haven't.
Yeah. Well, you know, he has a profile that we feel has a lot of very positive attributes. You know, he's very dynamic. He has good pace. He has good size. He's technically very sound. He has good feet for a player of his size. And, you know, the thing that, you know, I think we've seen over the years, you know, how Colombian players transition well into the MLS is that the tempo of that league is quite similar to the MLS. It's a very fast-paced, aggressive, up-and-down league. And so, you know, being able to get Mauro added to our roster, you know, we're real happy about it. We've been tracking him for the better part of 5 months. You know, he really burst on the scene last year when his coach inserted him into the starting lineup in the first division. And, you know, he went on a great run and actually ended up scoring the game, the decisive goal in the last seconds of their game to help them go into the playoffs to stay in the first division. Universidad's a smaller club. And then from there, you know, he's really become a key figure on that team, which garnered a lot of attention from the U-20 national team. He was a part of the process and a part of the team that qualified, that was in the qualification process in Uruguay, for the U-20 World Cup. So we watched him in all those games as well. He had three appearances, started against Brazil and scored a very nice goal. And, you know, really the plan, if we were going to get everything pinned up, was to get him added in the summer. And, you know, they have such a deep talent of players down there. When you look at, you know, clubs like Santa Fe and Deportivo Cali and Nacional, that he was really the last guy, the last decision to make on the roster. And the coach decided to go with a player from Deportivo Cali. We caught wind of it at the end of last week. I was on the plane the next day. to do what we can to get his physical done and get him out of it at the last second last night.
He's Mauro Manotas, 19 years of age, 6 goals and 32 appearances across all competitions in the Primera A and Copa Colombia. So that's probably another great piece for you when you look and you've seen that at 19 years of age, he's appeared 32 times in top-level games in Colombia.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not easy. It's a highly competitive league. Throughout this process, it's a 19-year-old kid. And so, there'll be a period of adaptation to the league and to a new city and to a new country. I mean, I actually went down and met with the kid's parents and with his little brother and his little sister were there as well. And, it's explained to them the Houston Dynamo, what we're all about, our project. And he's real excited about it. I mean, trust me, there's plenty of opportunities to go to several teams in the MLS, teams in Europe as well. And so we're happy that he really wanted to be a part of the Houston Dynamo.
He's Matt Jordan, the general manager of the Dynamo. So take my listeners, Matt, into sort of, they just see the end product here and somebody being signed, but they don't know generally, and neither do I for that matter. I do know it's a lot of phone calls. It's a lot of travel. It's a lot of checking the boxes that you feel and the club feels that he's got to check when it comes to, character, quality, adaptation, all these different things. Take us a little bit deeper into that, and then how many times you had to go down there and what it was like dealing with his club.
Well, his club has been great to deal with. Obviously, there's a representation group that we have a very strong relationship with in South America that helped facilitate things. We caught wind around November or December on Mauro and what he was doing down in the league. Several MLS teams were attempting to get him on board. We, through the discovery process, were able to get first dibs. And throughout that process, it's just a step by step process. You obviously see if that fits what the club, the management, and the coach are looking for. We'd then watch several games to see if the profile fits what we're looking for. Going from there, traveled down in person on two occasions, watched him live. Again, like I just said, met with the family, discussed, what was unique about our project. And then, when we caught wind that he was the last player that wasn't going on the U-20 World Cup team, it just really timing was on, it was and wasn't on our side, and that kind of all happened last, Thursday. And so then it was just a mad dash to basically get this thing done before last night. But I think the player's motivation is important. It's also the person, it helps a lot when you sit with a person's family. And I probably spent 2 or 3 hours with the family, and they had a lot of questions. Of course, they want, what's best for their child, as any of us would. Mm-hmm. And I just spoke from the heart, I mean, there was not really any bells and whistles, it's just, I just spoke from the heart about, what we're working towards and what our club's all about.
Matt, if we look at this player now, take us a little bit more into how you see him and how you and Owen Coyle and the club see him fitting in. Is this a defense stretching striker? Is this more of a target man? Is it a combination, a hybrid? Is he a guy that can play out wide in midfield as well as up front? Just take us a little deeper into what you think the potential of Mauro Manotas is.
Well, that's what I think is what's unique about Mauro. He has very good pace to stretch defenses. He can play as a lone striker with his back to goal and bring the team up the field. He can play as a second striker. He can play on a wide on either side, which he's played with the national team and with his club wide as well. So I think that's always useful for any coach, is that you have a player that can play a lot of different positions. And, Glenn, we've talked so many times, and from day one, we've been very clear about this, is that, we have a lot of quality players on our team right now. We have a lot of quality attacking pieces, but we're always looking to strengthen the team. And I and we firmly believe that competition in every position will get help us get the most out of the group to get us to where we want to go. And we're an ambitious group of individuals. And I, you know, right now I look at the roster, and I mean, there's competition in every position. And I don't see a lot of teams in the MLS have as much competition and depth as we do. And I strongly believe that that's going to help us get to where we want to go.
Well, Matt, thank you very much for joining us here tonight. As usual, thank you for giving us sort of the insight into the new signing, Mauro Manotas, 19 years of age from the Colombian First Division. Congratulations on, getting your man.
Yeah, we're excited about the group right now. And at the end of the day, it's all about the team, you know, and it's all about the team and how we can together get to where we want to go. And we're getting there one step at a time.
Matt, as always, thank you for being so candid. Thank you for giving us the real in-depth insight around the new Colombian young signing at 19 years of age, Mauro Manotas.
Thank you, Glenn. Have a nice night.
You too, Matt. Thank you very much. Break time. All right, welcome back to the show. Always great to hear from the manager of the opponent coming in. And this weekend, it is a good one. It is the Portland Timbers coming to BBVA Compass Stadium to take on the Houston Dynamo. This is one of the benefits of the Western Conference now. More games against differing teams like the Portland Timbers. Their manager joins us right now, Caleb Porter. Caleb, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome, Glenn. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, same to you. And I know you've been doing a lot of media today, so we'll make this quick and painless. Let's first talk about the importance of getting Diego Valeri back and this good result you guys had in Montreal.
Well, it's massive. You know, I've been saying this, anytime you lose a DP, you're not going to be as good. Obviously, you sign a DP because he's an impact player. And, you know, any team without their DP, with Houston a little bit, you see Cubo Torres. I mean, they're in the same situation. When he comes back, they'll be a notch better. You know, you look at an LA Galaxy without Robbie Keane, you know, and Landon Donovan, now all of a sudden they become a team that's grinding like everybody else. You know, so ultimately it's huge to get him back and even better that he scores in his first game. That's always important to get that first start under your belt and that first goal. It was really rewarding to see him get that goal and to see the smile on his face after a 6-month, you know, grind to get back to playing. I was really pleased to see him so happy.
Yeah, you've spoken to me about him before, not only the great skill set, the different way of looking at the game, but this is a guy that really seems to have a tremendous character, really seems to want to be an MLS, and I remember him saying once that, you know, in Argentina he couldn't even take his family to games.
Yeah, he's, he's been a professional for a long time, and over in Argentina, I've been over there. I've watched games live over there. You know, the pressure is immense. The fans are very passionate, but passionate in a somewhat negative, way in terms of, you know, it's not always the easiest place to manage. I mean, he's told me stories of, you know, you have to pay the supporters so your car doesn't get the window smashed in, and, you know, things like that. And I witnessed firsthand, fights in the stands. And, you know, so ultimately I think all those things considered, he loves, obviously, Argentina. His family's still there. But he wanted a new experience. He's got a little girl. He wanted to bring his family over to the United States and still play at a high level. He was in his prime when we got him, which is very unique. He was 25 years old. But I think it was everything about trying to help grow our club, continue to grow the league, and have a nice life for his family. Not in a way where he's retiring, like sometimes you see with players that come over, but in a way that's positive for our club, himself, and the league.
Caleb, how do teams just have to change in their approach just with him on the field? As you mentioned, DPs, you extract them from a team, it's a very differing look. Just having him back on the field, I would assume every single opponent now has to look at the Portland Timbers differently.
Well, it's one of the first signings that we made when I got the job. My preferred system, as you know, and I can adapt it. I've adapted it at times with my teams. But I prefer a version of a 4-3-3. You know, we're playing more of a double pivot 4-2-3-1, but I prefer a front three and I prefer a middle three. One of the first things I set out to do was sign a 10, you know, which you need to play this system. And, 2013, he was there. Last year, he's been one of our top producers in goals and assists and one of the best, you know, players in Major League Soccer. You know, so having him on the field is huge because he's kind of the guy that makes us go. You know, everything runs through him. He's a player that understands the tempo and the rhythm of a game. He can unlock defenses with final passes. And all of a sudden now Nagby comes to life a little more. Rodney Wallace comes to life a little more. The striker, Adi, comes to life a little more. And it's because he's the guy that he's kind of the straw that stirs the drink in our whole offense.
He's Caleb Poore, manager of the Portland Timbers here, coming to town to take on the Houston Dynamo at BBVA Compass Stadium Saturday night, 7:30. Your tickets at HoustonDynamo.com. A great opportunity to see a very explosive Portland Timbers with a number of great individuals. How about a little bit of an update on Will Johnson and when you expect to potentially get him back, Caleb?
Well, I've been saying this a lot. You know, Diego and Will have been rehabbing together for the last 6 months, but they have very different injuries. You know, an ACL return to play is extremely cut and dry. You know, it's black and white. They follow a set formula, you know, every single week. And, with Will's injury, it's not as black and white. They say anywhere from 6 to 10 months on a fib fracture. And the reason is, with a broken leg, there's a lot of muscles involved. Sometimes there's compensation, mechanical compensation that naturally occurs. Sometimes there's a psychology of having a broken leg and coming back. So they've pretty much been on the same track. They're both completely healed. You know, Will's leg is healed. But the final stage of being returned to play is a little bit trickier with a broken leg because he needs to be 90 minutes fit and 90 minutes capable in the holding mid position of flying around, tackling. And the other part of it is you play a game, then now you have to train again. And, you know, it's not as easy to come back from and be ready to play. And it's a little bit trickier too, because of his position. With Valeri, we can kind of bleed him in off the bench. With Will, like I said, we don't sub our holding mids. It's a position that, you know, you pretty much, if you start, you're going to play 90. So we've been gradually working him in with T2. He played 60 minutes, then he played 90 minutes consecutive weeks. And then he was very sore, you know. And the interesting thing, it wasn't his involved leg that was sore. It was his uninvolved leg because of, you know, somewhat of some compensation. It was something that we thought would happen. It's not a setback. It's just a natural part of the process. So we backed him down last week, and then he was in training today. We'll gear him back up. And then we have another decision to make. Do we get him another game with T2? Do we bring him in off the bench for us? These are decisions that we'll have to continue to make with Will to ensure that he comes back at the right time.
Caleb Porter joining us here tonight. Caleb, talk to me about the pressure in Portland, because, look, I mean, there is a very good, healthy pressure there. Fans, media, there are expectations. 1 point out of the playoffs last year. Talk to me about that, because, you know, I'm not sure every market is exactly like Portland when it comes to that.
I'm not so sure. I think there's pressure everywhere. I think every coach, every player, there's pressure. Whether that's pressure that the fans create, put on you, or whether you put it on yourself. You know, I've coached in games where there's 50 fans. I still feel pressure because ultimately I want to win every single game. So, you know, this word of pressure, I think it's something that I don't really think about too much. I do my job. I prepare my team every single week. I want to win every game. But ultimately, you know, we have goals. We fell short by a point last year. Finished with 49 points. So in the 2 years, we've gotten 57 points and 49 points, coming off of 2 years where they weren't in the playoffs, 2 years where they weren't, frankly, close. It's tough last year the way it ended, because ultimately we probably should have made the playoffs with the end that we had. But it's a very competitive Western Conference. And so now you don't make the playoffs. Now you roll into the next year. We have somewhat of a slow start. But if you look at the last four games, we've got two wins and a draw, and three of those four games are on the road. So we've grinded out 7 points in the last four games, and we're 1 point behind four other teams in the Western Conference. So, you know, for me, I don't think about, you know, the pressure. I think about the next game, and I think about the perspective of where we're at. And, you know, things can turn very quickly. We get another win here. We're up to fourth place, you know, tied with a few teams. So ultimately, yeah, there's pressure, but it's not something I think about. I think about doing my job every week. That's it.
Yeah, and I meant it in a positive way. Healthy pressure, I mean, lifts
everybody. I know what you meant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last question. We'll let you go, Caleb. And again, thank you very much for coming on the show. How about some just general observations of a different sort of era now beginning in Houston under Owen Coyle?
Well, I think they've been a team, and I've said this a lot about teams, and I think it's MLS. It's like Pulp Fiction. Everybody's killing everybody. But it seems like every week I say the team is a lot better than their points. And I believe that in our team as well. I think Houston is a team that's better than their points. And I think Owen's done a really good job of you can see the spirit that the team play with. I think they're better defensively. Although they've had a few games where they've given up goals, I do think they're better overall defensively. And I think they're a team that's very dangerous. They've got enough in the attack to scare you in Giles Barnes, who's probably playing the best football, certainly since he's come to MLS, which bodes, you know, for Owen's ability to manage him and get the most out of him. And you can see he's feeling good. But they got enough in the attack with him, Bruin, Boniac Garcia, Davis when he's in. Middle with Garrido and Clark, solid in a solid back four. So I think they're a very solid team, which is why you probably see in the Western Conference so many teams that are neck and neck. It's going to be a race till the end in the Western Conference. I don't think it's ever been this tight. I don't think it's ever been this competitive top to bottom in the history of the league.
Caleb, you're a gentleman for coming on. Thank you very much for taking the time out. I know it's a busy week, and we look forward to seeing you and your team come here to Houston on Saturday night.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. You take care, and all the best.
Okay, same to you. That's Caleb Porter, the manager of the Portland Timbers. It is always good to talk women's soccer, and it's always good to talk women's soccer with, quite frankly, one of the legendary players of the U.S. Women's National Team. And as we all know, the Women's World Cup will take place beginning in June in Canada, another big moment for the women's game globally. More teams involved at this event. And, of course, the United States trying to win that World Cup again for the first time since 1999. Joining us right now, three-time gold medal winner, a finalist for the 2005 FIFA World Player of the Year. Did you hear what I just said? Finalist for the 2005 FIFA World Player of the Year. She is Shannon Bock. Shannon, thank you very much for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, the more I read about you, and I already knew you were a remarkable story, but your remarkable story seems to get more remarkable. 37 years of age, you've won a gold medal three times. You have overcome a lot of different obstacles. First off, just tell me, what keeps you going?
I think just the drive and the love of the game. I mean, I think each time that I've either been injured or I was pregnant, the idea of coming back was always a must. I just love this game so much, and just being around the team and the adrenaline you get by going, you know, on the field in those big moments like a World Cup or an Olympics, is you can't get that back anywhere else. And so it's just that drive of like, oh, such a great experience, and you just want to keep enjoying it.
You know, you come back to this, the point of passion, and you know, the leagues are trying to make it here professionally and everything, and all these experiences that you have had. But in the end, when you say the words love of the game, I mean, is that really what the priority is always for you?
Always. I mean, I've always told myself the minute that this isn't enjoyable for me, then I'm going to be done. And I had moments of that, you know, where I kind of struggled with that at different points. You know, coming after college, I think there was a point that I gave it up and brought it back and said, wow, you know, I started playing with a local co-ed team and found the love of the game again. And that's what drove me to then play in the first league, you know, the WPS. And that's what got me going. And, you know, I think after 08, I was like, you know, should I be done? You know, is this my time? And something just always kept me going. And I always say that it's the love of the game, because I just know every time I get on the field and I touch that soccer ball, it's just, there's a passion that I still have for it. And again, I think, you know, the adrenaline that you get, you can't find that anywhere else. And I think that's the part that I'm going to miss the most when I do finally say I'm done.
Are you worried about losing that? Because it is pretty seductive, isn't it?
It is. It really is. I'm going to have to find something else to, you know, take over that, because you're never going to have that again. I mean, just even the other day, we were up in San Jose for our game, the send-off game, and the atmosphere, you just felt that electricity and that different feeling before, you know, that we hadn't felt in a long time. And it always, like, that I felt like it was the first time that I was like, oh my gosh, the World Cup is right here. It's right around the corner, because I could feel it in the fans. I could feel it in our teammates. And you just knew, like, okay, let's go. And you can't get that back anywhere else.
She's Shannon Box, U.S. national team midfielder, again, three-time gold medalist, has played in three Women's World Cups. She also played the game at Notre Dame and won a national championship there as well. The incremental rise in this game, I mean, you have spanned quite some time now, so you've seen it come, you know, you've seen the climbing of the rungs here in many places, certainly in the international game. Speak about that a little bit.
It's great. I mean, that's what we want, you know. And you look at when I came on the team, I was 26 years old. And, you know, the quality I thought was amazing then. But then now I'm looking at these young players that are, you know, trying to take our spots, pretty much these old veterans, so trying to take our spots. And just the level that they're at with their technique and the level of understanding of the game, it's so much higher than it was for me when I was their age. And it's so great to see just within the U.S. team, but then to also see other countries and just the quality that you're starting to see there. France, I mean, they're an amazing team. Japan has just come full circle, and you're just seeing some of these other teams that are just more and more soccer, more women's soccer, and they're just getting better and better. So the quality just keeps getting better, which is what we want. We want the game to improve.
I find it fascinating that you know, you mentioned France, you know, and culturally their team, much like the men's team, you know, they have their own nuances. Obviously, they're very technical, but there are some real similarities with the culture of each country, which transfers over to the way they play the game.
Definitely. You know, and I think that's the thing that you're starting to see a little bit, too. I mean, even I think I mentioned Japan. I just, you know, the tradition of their team is, okay, we're going to be very technical. We're going to keep small passes. And I think in prior years and big Olympics that we played them before, it's like, okay, well, we know we're going to have to struggle with them in the middle third of the field. But in the final third, you know, they're not that great. Like, they don't really like to take shots. They like to kind of be pretty. And France, I think, was like that kind of in the past. Like, in 2011, you started to see them rise, but they still have that, like, okay, well, we want to look pretty in the middle third. And once they got to the final third, it wasn't like, but now, man, we play them now, and they're so dynamic in the final third. And you saw that in Japan in 2011. They were taking shots. They were scoring lots of goals. And you're just seeing them transition to being better and better in more aspects of the game. And I think that's just a great quality for all the teams in the countries. And this World Cup is going to be amazing because the teams are so good.
She's Shannon Box, U.S. Women's National Team midfielder, has just had an outstanding career. As I looked over your resume and your body of work here, I was just like, wow, and it keeps going on and on and on. Now, I'm only mentioning your age, Shannon, because, you know, at 37, you know, a lot of athletes, their time is up, and it's up 7 years prior to you. Yours isn't up, but you've also sort of had to reinvent yourself, and you may have a more specialized role under Jill Ellis right now. Just explain that a little bit to us.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously, you know, I've always never tried to think of age as being a factor of when I should be done. It was more on how I was playing and can I still compete? And I think that I can. And I think that's what always drove me this past year of coming back is I believe I still can compete with the players here and the players that we're playing against. But I have had to reinvent myself. And I definitely have had this time around had long talks with Jill of what's my new role, you know, what will my role be? And it is going to be very different, but it's going to be more coming off the bench and supporting the team that way. My experience, it's going to be those types of things. But yeah, every time I've had to change, you know, I think with the lupus piece as well, the illness that I have, I had to really reinvent myself since 2010. So when last World Cup came and last Olympics, I was definitely doing things different to kind of keep my body going at the level that it needed to go.
Let's talk about the lupus, because this is also a part of the story here, because it's a, I guess it's an autoimmune disease. It affects your joints and things. You don't know when it flares up. How do you manage this? And I mean, are you just kind of at the beck and call of when it wants to sort of rear its ugly head?
Yeah, at times for sure. You know, I think that's the that's the big thing about lupus. It's very unpredictable. You know, they call it the cruel mystery just because you just have no idea when it's going to hit. I fortunately am on medicine that helps control it a little bit. I also, you know, every single person that has it has it differently. So I probably would say I'm more of a mild to medium case, and the medicine that I'm on helps with that. But, you know, you meet people that have it very severely, that can barely get out of bed and do different things. And I have moments of that with players, but overall, I'm really able to control it. I eat really healthy as far as gluten-free. I've learned, you know, different ways to lift weights so that I'm not putting more stress on my joints and my body and my muscles. But, yeah, it's when it hits. I mean, I had one last week, 2 days before the game, and I was like, okay, well, let's hope that it goes away within a day or two. And by the time the game came on Sunday, I was feeling great again. So, you know, you really don't know when it's going to hit, but now that I've had it hit a couple times, there are definitely days where I can say, okay, I need to maybe take it easier today. And I have the support behind me with this team. I definitely know in the camp before, I was like, Jill, I'm not feeling that great today. And she was very open to saying, okay, well, maybe we take it easy with you today. You can pull out whatever you need. So that support has helped a lot.
Your commitment, your ability, things you've overcome here, Shannon, just incredible. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Thank you so much for coming on. I'll tell you what, after the World Cup, when you guys win it, we'll bring you back on. How about that?
Awesome. That'd be great.
All right. Thank
you so much.
Thank you, Shannon. That's Shannon Box.
Okay.
The U.S. Women's National Team, what an amazing story. 37 years of age, she's going to her fourth World Cup. Probably a specialized role for Jill Ellis off the bench. Has had an outstanding career, has played throughout all the professional leagues here in the United States. The U.S. women are up in Canada this summer. The Women's World Cup begins in June. We'll take a break here. All right, welcome back to Dynamo All Access here as we wrap things up tonight. We're going to do it in style. And last night, over on Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5, a great friend of the show, Robbie Earle, was on. And we discussed what we thought we saw out of the Barcelona-Bayern Munich game. Plus, we began to foreshadow the Juventus-Real Madrid game. Now, with the knowledge that Juventus won it, I thought it might be a nice idea to just re-air the interview. Here is Robbie Earle of NBC. Let's start out with today, Bayern Munich and Barcelona. Mm-hmm. Boy, it sure is tough chasing a second leg down three goals against a team that's got Suarez, Messi, and Neymar Jr., isn't it?
For sure. You know, they were the difference in the end. You know, people call them the three amigos now. There's only two amigos second half, and maybe the power's in the three of them, because it didn't quite look the same with Suarez coming off at half-time. I believe it's some kind of tightening of calf muscles as a precaution. But when they click together, Glenn, it's the best front three in world football. And not just ability, because I think that that's easy for us all to recognise. But when you talk about the understanding between the three, the appreciation between the three of them, and the unselfish way with which they play. And listen, CR7, we know, is an outstanding player in Cristiano Ronaldo, but he's not as selfless as these three. And when I see a picture of whoever scored of the three of them, they all celebrate, you know, at the same level. As though, almost if you took a snapshot, you wouldn't know which one of the three has actually got the goal. They take a real kind of pride and appreciation in working together. And they were the difference in the end. Too much for a naive Bayern team defending. You know, came back a little bit spirited second half, but was had too much to do and couldn't handle the front three across the two games.
Robbie, everybody and their mother, a lot of people said, look, there's no way these three can play together. Neymar, yeah. Lionel Messi, and Luis Suarez. There's a lot of people eating crow right now. So my quick movement goes towards Luis Enrique, the manager.
Yeah, you have to say that. I always sort of laugh when people say that these three players or great players can't play together, because the one thing that great players have is an understanding of each other. They have an intelligence and a way of playing. And if you can get that unselfishness, if you can get that appreciation, so they play for the team and for each other as well as individually, Luis Enrique, you say, has to take a lot of credit from that, because it's not an easy job for a manager, and you've got to make sure that, you know, while egos are pampered to, that it's about the team eventually, and it's about the group. Certainly these three, you know, work as hard as anybody in the team. They look like they, you know, they don't stand on ceremony. You know, Luis Suarez sets a great example as the centre of the pitch for them. And, you know, the other two, Neymar and Messi, you know, play along to the same tune.
Are we seeing a Luis Suarez that has been tempered by all the off-field stuff and the attention? Mm. Has this, as in any off-field problems with players, some react to it in different ways. Are we seeing him tempered by that and focused more on being a good citizen and obviously
like
a player of Barcelona?
I think there's a maturity to his game now that's come into play. I think he's focused. I think he realizes that sometimes some of his off-field antics have shadowed what's been, you know, is a great career. He's a top-class player. And, you know, when he first got to the football club, he had to take his time. He was out for a while, and then his form wasn't great when he first came into the team. But he puts everything in. He gives 100% in terms of effort. So he's unique in many ways at the very top-class footballers, because generally they rely on their talent and their ability. But Luis Suarez brings that with the endeavour and the work rate of a local player or a player without that much ability, and he sets a tone for the team. And I think coming in and for people like Messi to see how hard he works and how giving he is to the team, it's even taking Messi's game up to another level. And Neymar now is starting to produce more, what I would say, more mature performances for him, you know, somebody so young.
Is there anything today, despite the fact that Barcelona, over the course of these two legs, advances pretty easily, is there anything today that the winner of Juventus and Real Madrid can take away from this Bayern series into the final in Berlin?
I think defensively, there's still a little bit of a soft spot around Barcelona. Set pieces, I think that they struggle on their defensive organisation, that will to get tight to someone, to head a ball away, to block something going towards goal. I still think would give you a little bit of hope. The way that Bayern came back in the second half, I know Suarez was off the pitch and probably had a bearing in terms of rhythm, but, you know, the way that Bayern came back into the game and created opportunities, you know, had some looks at goal, would give the likes of Real Madrid, with their attacking talent, I think some belief, would give Juventus, with maybe their better defensive structure, about closing, you know, they certainly won't defend as naively as Pep Guardiola, as Bayern Munich did against those front three. It won't be 1v1, oh, take me on, if you beat me, it's okay. I mean, there'll be blocks in front, there'll be, you know, lots of body contact, there'll be people easing people off the ball, they'll be nice and tight, they'll have a spare man in and around the danger area. So it's going to be a completely different game, whichever of the two come out of tomorrow's semi-final.
Does this set up pretty good for Juventus? Because in a way, maybe it makes Real Madrid play against maybe the nature of how they want to play. I mean, they've got to go after them. They've got to break down a deep defending team, basically.
For sure. I don't think, you know, one or two people are saying, oh, you know, Madrid have come out of it okay. I don't think, I'm not thinking it quite the same. I think Juventus will back themselves to be defensively strong, to not give too much away. They've got threats on the counter-attack. Paul Pogba believes back in the squad and could play a part tomorrow, and his surgery runs from deep could be something Real Madrid have to deal with. And it's not a Real Madrid team that's ticking on or feeling dizzy. It seems to be little confrontations and little cliques going on within the football club. And listen, if they were to go a goal behind or not open up Juventus as they'd like, sometimes those things sort of come to the fore a little bit more under those kind of circumstances. So it's an interesting game. Lots of subplots, lots of great players are on show. And it'd be more whether Juventus' defensive capabilities can clamp down on Real Madrid and make it a tight and difficult game.
Which leads me to the Premier League and not being able to navigate the Champions League now. We've got two Spanish teams. We've got an Italian team and, of course, a German team that exited today. Is there anything to that, or is it just a good year for these other clubs? And I mean, do we really see anybody in the Premier League that could have really gone far in this tournament? And of course, we got Jose Mourinho, who's won this before at Chelsea.
I think with Jose Mourinho and the Chelsea group, they will be the most disappointed. I still think there was a slight naivety about City in European football that is developing, but they're not quite there yet. Arsenal had one bad day at home to Monaco and pretty much did their sort of run in the competition as well. So I think, people went a little bit overboard that, from the quarterfinals, there was no English teams through from that point on. And, we have to look at English football. But I think that, there were circumstances with that. There was detail with the Chelsea performance against 10-man PSG. They should have taken care of business. Arsenal should never have lost in the manner they did to Monaco at the Emirates, give themselves too much to do. So I think we went a little bit overboard on that. But it is a lesson. I think English Premier League teams like to sort of wave that banner of the best league in the world. And I still think we have to sort of sometimes understand what best means. Is it the best, the most watchable, which I think in those terms, yes, it can hold its head up high. But in terms of best technical, in terms of best tactical, I still think at times the English teams have some way to go.
Yeah, you use the word naivety and naive in this, but then you look at the players. I mean, these are all very experienced players, experienced managers. Take me a little bit more into the detail of that tactical nuance, and what is it? Okay. Pinpoint it for me a little bit more.
One of the very big things you learn in English football, and it's bantered around very early on, you say you'll get a good, let's say, a midfield player in England, and the first thing he says, brilliant at winning the ball back. He's great at winning it back. I would say when you go into other European countries, the first thing they'll say is he's great at keeping the ball. Because if you don't give the ball away, you don't have to win it back. And there's a real different slant on the way that football's played. So one of the exciting things about the Premier League is the exchange of possession, that one team have it, they attack. It becomes like a basketball game at times. And it's great viewing, and we see late goals and lots of drama. But in European football, Glenn, you've got to do things a bit differently. You've got to play with a little bit more structure. You've got to play with a different rhythm. You've got to have a little bit more flexibility within your systems. You've got to take care of the football better than you do. So Arsenal, if they're losing 1-0 against Monaco on a bad night, it's a 1-0 defeat and you stay in the competition. Mm-hmm. If Chelsea need to develop a different way and get forward and get a goal, they do that. And so I do think it's those nuances, it's those little details that at times the Spanish teams and the German teams have taken a step on. But, it wasn't that long ago that English teams were making Champions League finals and winning them, the likes of Sir Alex Ferguson and Chelsea, obviously, before with Roberto Di Matteo. So it wasn't that long ago. We shouldn't sort of pile every criticism in. But I do think the style of the game, the English game, that is so rewarding and get so many global viewers around the world, sometimes hurts teams when they go into Europe, when they try and play with the same style.
Robbie, thank you so much for the insight tonight. Thank you very much for coming on the program. As always, it's great catching up with you.
Always a pleasure, mate. Speak to you soon.
All right, that's Robbie Earl, NBC analyst, played in the Premier League, also represented Jamaica. We wrap it up tonight in big style with Robbie. We thank you very much for listening here tonight. For producer Mike O'Carroll, I'm Glenn Davis. Good night, everybody, and remember, soccer matters.
Did you know that parents rank teaching financial literacy as the toughest life skill? That's where Greenlight comes in, the debit card and money app made for families.
With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and track spending with real-time notifications. Kids learn how to earn, save, and spend responsibly, while parents have peace of mind knowing smart money habits are being built with guardrails in place. Try Greenlight risk-free today at greenlight.com/trygreenlight. That's greenlight.com/trygreenlight.